Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology on the New Books Network. I'm Jacob Doherty, the host for this episode. Today we're talking to Jaime Alves, author of The Anti-Black City, Police Terror and Black Urban Life in Brazil, published in 2018 by the University of Minnesota Press. Jaime is Assistant Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at the College of Staten Island in the City University of New York, and a research affiliate at the Centro de Estudios Afrodiaspóricos at the Universidad ICESI in Colombia. Jaime Alves, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jacob. Thank you, listeners of the new anthropology book series.
So to get started, I was going to ask you, you write that this book is informed by your own experience of state violence and your participation in social movements in Brazil. So to get the conversation going, could you tell us a bit about your own background and how you came to write this book?
Sure. This book came out from my own experience coming to age in a favela in São Paulo. I am from northeast Brazil, just to situate the listeners. In the northeast of Brazil is a part of the country that have a historical background of slavery, of poverty. So in the 90s, in the 80s, in the 90s, many people would migrate to São Paulo, the southeast of Brazil. So I'm a part of this generation that had to migrate to this other part of the city. And of course, we go to the favelas, the shanty towns. So my experience coming to age in this particular shanty town in São Paulo, one of São Paulo's favelas, full of human tragedies, police violence, drug traffic, domestic violence, poverty, unemployment. So it really informs my experience and how I write the book. The book is written out of rage, in a good way, but rage, and also frustration because I see most of the youth that shared this path with me during this time, this troubling time, most of them are killed or incarcerated. So this is part of my experience, and I think what makes the book maybe hopefully accessible to the reader is that I put emotion, I put my own experience up front there.
Yeah, absolutely. And the book is very richly ethnographic. So can you talk a little bit about the fieldwork process for that you went through?
Yes. So the book, part of the book comes from my experience working as activism as well, activist in São Paulo. So after some years, like my 20s, I started to join the black movement to work with affirmative action policies for black youth victims of police violence. So this gave me access to most of this group. For my favela background, it gave me access to prisons, to other places. And this made the ethnography be very, I would say, multi-sided ethnography. The methodology is very diverse. At some times, I am in the favela, and another day, I am in downtown, in a protest in downtown, or visiting a friend in the prison, or going to the cemetery to visit with the parents of a youth killed by the police. So this really helped me in a very tragic way to write the book in a way that connects these distressed geographers. When I went to fieldwork, let's put in quotation marks fieldwork, but when I went back to do this work after going to the graduate school, I didn't anticipate that the book would take this form. This experience, my experience, and my activism in these different fronts led me to design a methodology that would cover these dispersed manifestations of police violence, of state violence. So the methodology is basically created by the own dynamics of everyday life in these places full of human tragedy.
Yeah, and so you don't have the kind of scene of the classic immersive field site, and so maybe this is why fieldwork is a problematic word, but nonetheless, the book is incredibly rich as you follow these kind of key actors throughout the city and follow them across the way their itineraries dissect the town.
Well, this is a very good point that you make, because you know, at the same time that I was very familiarized with this, and we know that anthropology is precisely the point of the immersing oneself in an unfamiliar place and to become familiarized, become closer and closer, and to have like what Clifford says, a thick description. In this case, I had two different situations, because at some times I was too familiar. I was totally comfortable to be there, to be with friends, and be in the favela, and be in the community doing activism work. At the same time, it also created extra pressure for the so-called native anthropologists. So people are fighting for survival. They struggle for basic needs, for the right to live. And then I am there doing my work, my ethnographic work. At the same time, that was familiar. I'm seen as a familiar face, somebody that from the community, that belongs to the community. There was huge expectations about what I should do as somebody from there. So crossing these two different worlds, the academic world and the favela, the place where my friends and other people are, made these, created false expectations of what I could do as anthropologist. And of course, as anthropologists, we must agree, we don't do almost nothing.
And so before we dive into the individual chapters, could you perhaps lay out the main arguments that you make throughout the book that kind of structure the course of the narrative?
Sure. Well, the book tries to dialogue with this literature, mainly with this literature on the right to the city. So in Latin America, this literature has been very prolific. There are several very interesting works showing the marginalized poor in Latin America, racialized cities. They fight back against the social injustice. They claim the city through different tactics, through different strategies to make life livable in this space. What I try to do is to put the racial equation in this conversation. And by that, I mean centralizing blackness as a key point. If, as the literature says, in Latin America, the right to the city is a cross alliances, broad alliances among different sectors of the marginalized population. What we do when even among the marginalized population, there is a strong feelings of anti-blackness. So this pervasive ideology of anti-blackness is so present even among the marginalized, that makes this conversation very difficult. So the point that the book tries to make is that if you want to think just spatial justice, spatial justice, just cities in Latin America, we have to centralize blackness. A utopic place that we call Blackopolis. So Blackopolis would be the utopic place where black life can be livable.
And so that...
So this is basically the argument that I want to make. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of analysis requires speaking back to the kind of ideology of racial democracy that structures public life in Brazil. Is that right?
It is absolutely right. So exactly, we are, I tried to bring this bank again to join all the colleagues to disrupt this mythology of racial democracy in Brazil, precisely by showing how urban utopia, all these fantasies of urban life in Brazil, is anti-black in its core. So the very foundation of Brazil, and there I call, I invite the reader to think the city as the polis, as the Greek city reference of the city state. So we talk about the Brazil as a polity. So Brazil is a country founded on anti-blackness. So this exactly calls into question the myth of racial democracy. How is it a racial democracy when we have thousands of black people killed every year by the police? The favela itself as a reference that takes us back to slavery. So all these spatial references, the favela, the prison, the cemetery, all these are black spaces, or we could say black space. And this space is calling to question the ideology of racial democracy. That says that in Brazil, racial boundaries are supposedly blurred. So we have a ambiguity because in Brazil, everybody are mixed. So spaces are mixed, people are mixed. So there is a gray zone that makes it very hard to identify who is black, who is white in Brazil. Well, the book shows that in Brazil, the police has an incredible capacity to draw racial lines in bodies and in territories through death. So when the police is killing black people in the favela, the police is doing nothing but creating space, creating the favela. Of course, that is not only my argument. There are many scholars in this spatial theory, in anthropology, mainly in Latin America, that you are making also this claim, and this is a very important claim that I joined in this conversation.
And Sao Paulo is really the stage where a lot of the bulk of the ethnography takes place. So can you introduce us a little bit to the city? It has a population of 12 million people, and it's the largest city in Brazil. So can you maybe outline a bit about the city and what you would identify as the central features of what you call Brazilian apartheid in Sao Paulo?
Yes. So São Paulo is the commercial center of Brazil. So the São Paulo's elite, they claim to be themselves the leaders of Brazil, and São Paulo has 40% of the Brazilian population. So most of the people coming from the north and northeast Brazil, running away from slavery after abolition in 1888. Most of them came to São Paulo. São Paulo was the place that we had the coffee boom. So in the late 1900s. So since then, power in Brazil has shifted to Southeast, because before that, Northeast Brazil, we have the sugar crisis. Sugar cane was the main product, and we had all these slave owners with the huge sugar plantations. So when we have by the end of the 18th century, it started a decline in sugar production, and we moved the Brazilian central power moves to São Paulo. And since then, São Paulo continues to be the main center, industrial and commercial center of Brazil. This is a very anti-black formation. The elite, Brazilian elites, most of the São Paulo elites, they are trained. They were trained in French. In French, the design of the city, the design of São Paulo as a city, was made by French architects. So many of these missions, civilizing missions, came to São Paulo to create the city. We have many neighborhoods in the city that give us the example, Hygienopolis, the city of hygiene, or climatation. So names that limited associated to cleanliness, to hygiene, to sanitation. So this is just to give the listener a little bit of how they lived and thought São Paulo as a white city. It was a white city. So what we do with all these black people coming from northeast Brazil migrating to São Paulo? So the elite by the end of the 19th century was terrorized. The elite was terrorized. What we do? So they enforced the strict urban policies to prevent blacks from occupying downtown city. They created the informal apartheid cities in which the black people would be located. They gave immigrants, European immigrants, access to land, free access to land. So they have several policies that helped them to make São Paulo a white city, from favoring Europeans in the access to land and the markets to prevent black people from occupying particular parts of the city. So nowadays, what we have in São Paulo is a city that, again, is a symbol of a Brazilian imperial colonial power. We have a city that is deeply racialized. Most of the black people live in the favelas in the high periphery or in downtown, we call Cortiço, downtown, very precarious areas, shanty house in the middle of the city. We have in the city this policy that many activists call cleaning with fire, in which suddenly a favela is set on fire. Well, the favela is burning. What's happened? Nobody knows. And after the favela is burnt down, comes all these urban designers and create a sophisticated plaza, square, or create a housing, fancy house policy for the elite, condominiums for the elite. So we still have in place these very anti-black urban policies that made São Paulo be what it is.
And the book really shows the way that policing plays a central role in the production and the maintenance of the spatial order. And throughout, you detail the entanglement between two forms of rule that you call necropolitical governance on the one hand and soft urban governance of human security regimes on the other. So maybe starting with the latter, could you explain a bit about the transition you identify from tough to soft policing and tough to soft neoliberal governance in the city?
Yes, so that's a very good point to introduce the chapter 2. In the chapter 2, I try to bring this conversation, this apparently contradictory policies, right? Necropolitics and biopolitics. I deal a little bit with Foucault and notions of biopolitics in the sense that Nicholas Rose calls attention to this, how in modern life, modern society, advanced society, so-called advanced liberal society, there is a set of policies that he calls governing through community, right? So in the case of São Paulo in the 90s, we can locate in the 90s a shift in these policies. So suddenly the favelas, the periphery of the city becomes this laboratory. We have to train the poor to be a better entrepreneur of themselves, to get a job. We have to tame this troubled youth, black youth. And we have to develop several pedagogical projects to kids, to get the kids out of drugs. So several spatial disciplines as well. So cleaning, paving streets, so several policies there to reinforce the discipline, spatial discipline of this problematic urban poor, mainly urban youth. So at the same time that you had this, and just to complete, one particular feature of this biopolitical regime was the invitation for the poor participate in this decision making process regarding security. So it is very ironic that at this time, at the same time that the government was imposing very drastic, cruel neoliberal policies that threw many people out of poverty, in poverty, in unemployed, cutting services, social expenditure. So at the same time that the government had these drastic measures to downsize the state, the government was exciting people, inciting people to participate in security meetings. So you can close your eyes and imagine all these meetings in the favelas in the weekend, in which people were invited to say where the police should be. People would be invited to tell the police where is the dot spot, to tell the police who are the troublemakers. So at the same time that the government was withdrawn from providing basic services, was inviting people to participate in security issues. So we have the democratization of security and the privatization of all other social regimes of social protections. So this is what I'm calling here the tragic combination of necropolitics and biopolitics. At the same time that the government was expanding people's access to participate in security matters, we had this intensification of police violence. So mass incarceration skyrocketed by the 90s. São Paulo became, by the end of the 90s, São Paulo became the country's leading state in incarceration of black people, of people in general, and black people in particular. And of course, we had this enduring regime of racial terror by the police. The police never stopped producing dead black dead bodies, but by the 90s, there was an intensification of it. But now let me tell you, the book becomes obsolete very quickly. The book came out in 2018, but it's already obsolete. If I would have to stay again to restate again the argument in this chapter, I would tell the reader that, well, the police, that I was very astonished when I was writing the book and revised the data from the 90s and the 2000s. Now, in 2019, the police is beating its own record again and again and again. So the book becomes very, very obsolete very quickly in terms of mass incarceration, police violence. And yet, the democratization of security in the sense of the people's participation in these matters continues to be a biopolitical practice in the favelas. And the police continues to export this model to other parts of Latin America. This is a very important point that I want to make, because São Paulo's police, as brutal as it is an exporter of policing technology or policing training to all the Latin American countries.
And that was facilitated by a series of international cooperations through international development and international finance associations. Is that right?
Exactly. The UN development program. Many international think tankers, all these international organizations trying to push the agenda of development and associating the agenda of development to the agenda of securitization. There are several great work doing this argument. Tony Samara from Cape Town in South Africa. And this is particularly true as well to São Paulo, to Brazil. In securing the city or developing the city means securing the city. And securing the city means engaging black people, incarcerating or killing black people.
And you write that this kind of violence is a productive form of imagining and enacting the Brazilian state. So can you expand a bit on that idea and what you see as the consequences of this kind of violence and terror for how we should understand neoliberal urban governance in general?
The point here that I think is that we think about sovereignty, and I think in anthropology we have some great conversations on how the body becomes the exercise of sovereign power, right? So the book is trying to advance or join this argument, trying to locate in the black body the place for the enactment of the state sovereignty. And this only makes sense if we accept that in the Brazilian polity, in the Brazilian context, black people are regarded as enemy of the state, enemy of civil society. So the classic distinction political scientists make between criminal and enemies. For the criminals, the law. For the enemies, death. So in the case of Brazil, black people are conceived as enemies of the state and enemies of civil society. And therefore, the only way that they can be tamed is through killing and incarceration. This is very prevalent in the sense when you see, for example, how the police occupies the favela during the World Cup or the Olympic Games. These images, these TV images circulate in the world in which the police and the army occupies the favelas to pacify these areas. But in truth, the message here is to secure it. The city for white tourists, for white Brazilians. So in that sense, what I see in Brazil in this new moment, new old moment, if you will, is that the new liberal state, the Brazilian new liberal state, exercises its sovereignty on the black body. The black body is the site, the locus for the exercise of Brazilian state sovereignty. So killing black people is also about making the state or reclaiming the state and reclaiming the state and reclaiming the city at the same time. So this process, what João Vargas called taking back the land, this process of reclaiming the territory, the bodily and the spatial territory, is a process of the killing. And then this macabre engineering is a macabre engineer. That is why it's a necrobiopolitical, because at the same time that it produces death, it also produces the city and it produces the state. So that is what I feel is like a central feature of the Brazilian state, is that it exercises its sovereign power through the killing and incarceration of black people.
And then so throughout the ethnographic work, you follow the kind of production of black life in the context or under the sign of this kind of constant death. So in chapter one, Macabre Spatialities, you introduce two women, Donna Cecilia and Donna Maria, and their sons, Lucas and Betinho. So can you tell us a bit about how you met these women and what you learned about their jobs, their family lives, and their mourning, and what this tells us about the gendered production of race and space in Sao Paulo?
Yes, so I met Dona Maria when I was doing activism with black youth in the favela. I had an aunt that lived in the favela close by. And so I was very familiarized with the region, and I was working with black youth in this educational center for increasing the participation of black youth in public universities, the CORA system. And then I knew about the case of Betinho, because Betinho was one of the many black youth that were killed, black and poor youth that were killed by the so-called slaughters. That was a death squad in the periphery of São Paulo. And through Dona Maria, I knew Dona Cecilia and many, many other women that are not featured in the pages of this book. Many other women. So these two cases are samples. Tragically, they are samples to understand this regime of terror in the periphery of São Paulo. Betinho was a car washer. He worked as a car washer. He was 23 years old by this time. His brother was participating in a famous gang in the periphery of São Paulo. And Betinho and Lucas was the son of Dona Cecilia. He worked with Dona Cecilia selling yogurt and door-to-door, selling small products to make a living for her. Both women were black women. Dona Cecilia, as I say, was a street vendor. Dona Maria was used to work as a domestic worker, but she was then sick and she couldn't work anymore. So she depended on Betinho's money to survive, to live. The place, the paradigmatic place that these two women occupy in the book, for me, is a political statement that we cannot understand police terror or state sovereignty in Brazil, in racialized places like Brazil, without understanding the place that black women occupy in these politics of security. And this is very prevalent, not only in the sense that they are the mothers, the sisters, the girlfriends of black men that are admitted the majority of the ones killed by the police, but they are also direct victims of police violence and the state violence as well. Black feminists have invited us to think about state violence in a more broader way, not only the way that the state produces like the dead bodies on the streets, as in the case of black men that is a prevalent victim of police violence, but also the other uncountable and still very prevalent forms of social death, traumas that black women pass through physical violence, to the physical killing, but also through the psychological terror, the everyday humiliation, working as domestic workers, the violence of spatial segregation, infrastructural violence, so different forms of violence that makes the female black body as the center, as the locus for the exercise of this violence. So the book tries to make this by centering these two stories, the story of Dona Maria and Dona Cecilia, not only in relation to their kids, but also in relation to the history of dispossession, the history of labor exploitation, the history of spatial segregation that they passed through as they moved from a different state, different parts of Brazil to São Paulo as black migrants.
And you also put them at the center of chapter 5 that's called Bringing Back the Dead. And you put the activism surrounding black motherhood in particular, and what you refer to as the dialectic of black motherhood at the center of this chapter, where you're trying to theorize what it is to live and be active and produce an alternative in the context of this. So can you tell us a bit about this idea of the dialectic of black motherhood and why you see it as so central to combating anti-black racism, as well as, kind of surprisingly, you see it as central to combating heteronormativity?
Yes, thank you, Jacob. This is a dialogue with Patricia Hill Collins, Joy James, and many other colleagues, Luciene Rocha, and many other colleagues that have taken the lead to understand the place, the role, the predominant role of black women in sustaining black lives in these places of anti-blackness. And this is a very important point that they are making, because in these specialities, what makes life possible is the labor of black women. Not only the reproductive labor of everyday life, domestic work, economic work, but also the political activism, the political labor that they embrace to make life possible. That's why then I bring this conversation by analyzing very closely the work of Mães de Maio. Mães de Maio, or Mothers of May, are the mothers of the ones killed by the police in 2006, when within 1 week the police killed more than 500 youth, most of them again black youth in the periphery of São Paulo. So the mothers of this youth came together, tried to mimicry the work of Mothers of May of Argentina, the victims of the Argentinian dictatorship in the 70s and the 80s. So, but what they are doing here differently is racializing this conversation about the disappeared, And this is a very important point, because what mothers of May, Mães de Maio, are doing is they are saying, well, democracy never worked in Brazil. The mothers of May in Argentina were making the point that, look, we live in a state of exception. The mothers of May in Brazil, they are calling attention to the fact that the 2006 massacre was just one event in an enduring regime of terror that makes Brazil be what Brazil is, an anti-black place. So they are calling into question the very assumption, the very idea that we have about democracy, and they are shifting. They are shifting the conversation not only in political activism, because they are radicals, ungovernable. They call themselves, we are ungovernable, we cannot be domesticated. So they are shifting the conversation not only in the political, in the spectrum of political activism in Brazil, but also in academia. How do we come to terms to the fact that these black women are saying that Brazil is not a democracy in face of all this scandal that we see activists and scholars alike in Brazil talking about Bolsonaro, the rising of Bolsonaro as a threat to democracy, when these black women say, we live in a permanent state of exception. This is not an exception. It is part of Brazil. Our Brazilianness is founded on black suffering, founded on black terror.
So I was going to ask this a little bit later, but let me raise it now since you brought him up. I was going to ask what your research tells us about Bolsonaro and the forces that brought him into power. It seemed like in a lot of ways his electoral success was predicated on popular fatigue with the soft hand of the police and by mobilizing a very powerful anti-black necropolitical desire that was articulated around this logic of vengeance. So how do you think we should understand him in light of your research and in the context of Brazilian urban and racial history?
Yes, I think Bolsonaro complicated the things here, right? Because it's very hard. It's very hard to think about Bolsonaro in the sense like we don't want to say, well, Bolsonaro is not different from Lula da Silva, from the Workers' Party that was in power before Bolsonaro, or any other government. And yet we know the implications of this. Bolsonaro is a openly sexist, homophobic, anti-black, anti-women. His result of this anti-black, anti-woman, homophobic coalition. That is very clear. At the same time, and that's what the Madre de Mayo say, if we take serious Brazilian history, if you take Brazilian history seriously, we will see that there is no difference. The Workers' Party, with all the social advancement that it provided, social policies for the poor, affirmative action policies, land distribution, economic reform, even timid. So all this that the Workers' Party did was not sufficient. It was not enough to curb anti-black violence. By the contrary, the Workers' Party encouraged anti-black violence. If you see, for example, the policies in place for protecting tourists during the Olympic Games and the World Cup, this was policy designed by the Workers' Party. Even though the state level government had a stronger part of the responsibility, the Workers' Party was the one behind most of these policies, deploying, for example, the National Guard to protect tourists and kill black civilians in major cities. So all this shows the telling contradiction of the left in Brazil. The left is also anti-black. What unites black, right and left in Brazil, it seems to me, and this is a point that I make with a colleague, João Costa Vargas, is that both of those political spectrums come together when the black body is this center of violence. They cannot, they are unable, or they call for violence against the black people. During the Workers' Party administration, the UN called for the abolition of the military police, a police with out of control. And they not only dismissed this claim, but they also reinforced investment in security. So all this brings Jair Bolsonaro to power as a scandal for democracy, in the sense of, wow, how can Brazilian democracy produce this disaster? But for most of us, and for the mass of the MEI familiarized with Brazil, it was predictable. Predictable because anti-blackness is very diffuse in Brazil. The fact that many of the poor also support Bolsonaro is not contradictory to everything that I'm saying about anti-blackness and black people support Bolsonaro. No, it is not. Because anti-blackness is diffused in every aspect of everyday life, including among the marginalized poor, including among the direct victims of police violence. That's also why many black men that are police officers supported Bolsonaro. Maybe they are very familiarized with the way that the Brazilian society is organized, so familiarized that they may not see, or they may just accept that anti-blackness is part of the Brazilian community.
So on the other hand to that, you also describe the kind of the history and the formation of a black movement in Brazil that's organized often under the rubric of demands for a second abolition. So could you say a bit about that movement and its history and what some of the main strategies they use and dilemmas that they face?
So the black movement denounces the need of a second abolition, because abolition in Brazil was a farce. Black people live in a plantation regime. This is a plantation regime that, regardless if the left or the right, they live in a plantation regime. And by that, I don't mean to support Bolsonaro and not to denounce the lawfare against Lula da Silva as a political prisoner in Brazil. Maybe everything that is happening with Lula da Silva, as João Costa Vaga has said elsewhere, is that Brazil is so familiarized with the face of black people in spaces of suffering that even like the timid social advancements of black people disrupted these places and created so much hate. So what we see is rage against black people, rage against the timid social advancement. These black people should not be, for example, taking airplane, be in the airport, be in shopping malls, be in spaces of white privilege. These are not places for you. So Bolsonaro's victory is, in fact, a reassertion of the places of the black people. Where should be the lines draw between both of them? So in this sense, the black movement is called for a second abolition, because they say, well, we live in a farce. It's a democracy that is a farce. And for black people, this is a condition of slavery, a slavery condition. But the only point that I make in the book, and I think it's connected with your question, is actually the failure of the black movement. And this is a very controversial point that I make in the book. I think friends in the black movement would not like it. But what I see is a failure of strategy. Although the black movement has for years, for decades, tried to call attention of civil society and the state to the drama, to the suffering of black people, they have been unable to sensibilize them. So the question then becomes, what is that about black suffering that these cries fall into deaf ears? Protests, strikes, hunger strikers, protests, all these forms of occupying the governor's office, all this kind of a protest has been unable to stop the machine of death. The black social movement have followed the script, civil society's script, protest peacefully, goes try to do some political pressure in the Congress. All these scripts, the legal grammar designed for claiming rights in a democratic society have not been enough to stop black genocide in Brazil. So what we left here for us to think is all the forms of black protest that have been marginalized from the political lexicon of the left because they are seen too radical, too outlawed, too violent. And at the same time, maybe one of the few possibilities for black voices be heard in a society that refuses to take black suffering seriously. So that's my take about the black movement. The black movement has been very incisive in denouncing the need for a second abolition, denouncing the plantation regime, in denouncing police terror, mass incarceration, and at the same time, because of black social movement has relied on the grammar, the legal grammar of political society, of civil society, they have been unable to stop all this machine of death.
And I think one of the most challenging projects that you take up in the book in chapter 4 called Sticking Up, you try to think about what are some of the other forms of politics that you might be able to identify that might not be the most obvious to label as political. And so in that chapter, you describe the way that young black men respond to criminalization and challenge the racial and spatial order of the city through their participation in the drug economy and the criminal activities that surround it. So can you introduce us a bit to the PCC? Tell us who they are, what they do, and how they came to be, and then perhaps a bit about why you theorize young black men's involvement in this as a form of tragic agency.
Yeah, PCC is a self-named criminal organization in the periphery of São Paulo. It emerged during the 90s when the state of São Paulo was imposing this federal government was imposing this new drug legislation, the drug statute, criminalizing drug users. So we have an escalation of mass incarceration in São Paulo. So as I said, the state of São Paulo became the first runner, the number one in mass incarceration. At the same time, then that we had this massive incarceration of black youth, we had also the emergence of the PCC. And PCC recruited most of its soldiers within the prison. So, in a certain extent, the state was creating the PCC by creating the conditions of recruitment of black youth within the prison. To be clear, not all members of PCC are black. Most of it is, for example, the leaders of the organization are not black. But yet, and this is a controversial point that I make in the book, and the colleagues working on PCC may not agree, is that most of its low-ranking soldiers are black young men, favelados, from the favela. And this what calls my attention is to see PCC as a political practice, as a criminal agency, because the question for me becomes, why has PCC been able to recruit so many black youth and we couldn't do the same in the black movement? All the forms of, say, pedagogical practices in the favelas, for example, the evangelicals. So all these, the evangelical churches, the state of its pedagogical projects, all these projects try to recruit black youth, and they haven't been able to do the same that the PCC has done. PCC has regimented so many youth that we don't know exactly the number of soldiers in the organization. Some people say that 30,000, other people say that 100,000 people. So we have a huge amount of black youth recruited by PCC and doing some kind of work, political work, that for the left is very hard to consider as political. But at the same time, we may ask ourselves, what does political, to act politically mean in contexts in which civil society is closed to black politics? Space of civil society, if the space of civil society is closed to black politics, should we consider black criminal practice as a strategy to open a tiny space for black voice, for black demands be heard? So of course, then the question becomes, well, what is the political, what is the potential for change in these isolated, self-serving criminal practices? Well, we may not look, we may not find the answer for this if we look for political action based on the leftist or Marxist model of political action. We may, and here I'm engaged with Philippe Bouvard, with Trayvon Gardner, with even with James Scott in the conversation about everyday forms of resistance. But these forms of resistance, at least for black people, must be conceptualized differently, not within the lexicon of the leftist politics.
And so you write there that mass incarceration really forms the backdrop for this organization. And that's something that you explore in more detail in Chapter 3, The Favela to Prison Pipeline, where you really try to deconstruct the spatial difference between the favela and the prison and show the ways that the favela operates itself as a form of prison and the prison itself operates as a form of favela. So can you expand a bit more on this argument and why you see it as so central to understanding the shape of Brazilian apartheid?
Yes, I think this is very central for the conversation that we are talking, because since we are centering this conversation on spatial politics, when we see the geography of São Paulo, we see the spatialization of injustice, of punishment. By that, I mean the victims of police violence are the ones that live in the periphery. The periphery is very fragmented by spatial segregation, by poor design of public transportation, by disinvestment, by political marginalization, fragmented by police terror. And at the same time, when you go to the prison, and that was my experience as a prison abolitionist, visiting the prison every week. So you go to the prison and you think and you are invited to think the prison as a special unity that unites fragmented geographies of the city. So this really sparked my attention. It really called my attention to think how this fragmentation of state violence comes to be unified in bodies and space. So the prison, the jail, is not just a jail itself. It is what Dylan Rodriguez called a prison regime. It's an ideology. It's a program of government. So this rationality of the government that informs state practices in Brazil can be better described through this prison favela pipeline. The manifestations, the fragmentation, the fragmented manifestations of state terror comes to be coherent, comes to be organized through these spatial arrangements of bodies and the space in the favela and in the prison. That's one point. The other way that you think about this and complement one another is that favela and prison are not different. As Assata Shakur would say, these two places are products of the same regime of the power. If the favela before, if the favela in the genealogy of Brasilia politics of space, as we would say, the favela resemble the slave quarter. So the same way the prison nowadays is the plantation. So these two places that were connected before, the slave quarter and the plantation, now we see the prison and the favela as part of the same geography. So So the space geographies of the surfery comes to be united through this pipeline. The bars that are in the favela are the same bars that are in the prison and vice versa.
That brings me to a question about the way that the book is one of the most sustained engagements that I've seen so far in anthropology with the philosophical tradition that's often called Afro-pessimism. So you draw specifically on the work of Saija Hartman and Hortense Spillers and on the Fanon-inspired theorists Jared Sexton and Steve Martineau, as well as their interlocutors like Catherine McKittrick and Fred Moten. And so one of the big ethical debates that you raise that informs your ethnographic approach concerns the centrality of death in defining the Black experience and the centrality of suffering in particular. And you cite the way that this risks undermining Black political agency. So can you say a bit about how you navigated this tension in the ways that you write Black urban life in the context of the necropolis?
Yes, thank you for this question. This question is actually a very hard one because, you know, I keep myself admittedly ambiguous in some of this debate. And to be honest about this, is a very important conversation and yet very difficult for anthropologists, as you said. This is a work that tries to engage this conversation that have been done mostly by critical film critique film studies or literature, political science. So it is very hard when you go to do field work or you try to engage with these theoretical claims that are very important and necessary. But when you engage with them in the space of everyday life, it is very hard. So at the same time that I take very, very serious the Afro-pessimistic premise that in this social world, we still live the afterlife of slavery, that Black people are slaves, and that in this regime, humanity and the Blackness are two opposed, are unreconcilable positions. So if we take this serious, and we must take this serious, it becomes very hard to engage with this conversation when you see that your interlocutor, your friends, the people that you work with in the field, they not necessarily think in these terms, right? They do not sometimes conceptualize their experience in these terms. So I ask, how would Dona Maria, for example, or Serginho, or Betinho, or Dona Cecilia see the claim that they are socially dead, that Black people live in the time and space of death, of permanent death? So I take the Afro-pessimistic point very serious, but I also take Fred Moten's warning very serious to try not to put Black people in a position of a death-driven subject, a subject that is irreparable, a subject that is beyond the reclaim of his or her agency. So I try to look at this agency in the world of crime. The world of crime is how Black people define the place in which they live. And this world of crime is the place in which they position themselves beyond the law. So all this conversation of law, of human rights, of humanity, all this collapses because these Black men engaged in the world of crime, they are not invested in this conversation about civil society politics or the conversation about legality. So if civil society in the state treat them as enemies, so this condition of enmity is the one that informs their practice. So I think that may be, and I hope I was successful in trying to bridge the conversation between Afro-pessimism and Afro-optimism by showing that in the world of crime, the socially dead is politically alive. We can certainly say that this conversation about the world of crime is very male-centric, because most of the subjects that appear there in the PCC, for example, are black men, are male. Yes, but I bring also some other contexts in which I show how Luana and Nina, two black lesbian girls, young women, they engage with this politics as well. One selling drugs on the housing project where she lives, another incarcerated for sticking up with her brother. So all these are also manifestations in which we can see that the outlawed, by default, outlawed black subjects reclaim the space of crime or the world of crime as a way to reassert their political life. The ultimate question for us then becomes, what is political? How do we define political action when these actions sometimes goes against the interests of the black community itself?
That's a really great question, I think, to wrap up our discussion of the book. But before we go, could you tell us a bit about the project that you're working on at the moment?
Yes, at the moment I'm working on... Well, this is a good question because it ties to the previous one. Now I'm working on some forms of hope, black hope. Try to find hope in some space of despair. I am working with black youth engaged in gang violence in Cali, Colombia. The listener may know that Colombia has been passing through a peace deal. The main FARC guerrilla group has signed a deal with the government. And now we have all these international donors, this so-called peace industry, coming to Colombia, coming to Cali, try to discipline these urban, troubled urban youth, how to take opportunity in this moment, in becoming peace builders themselves. So the question from me here is, how do we understand all this technology of government in face of so many deaths, the killings of black activists, poverty, unemployment? So I try to look at this through the lens of black youth participating in gang violence. I try to see how and why all these projects of peace building collapsed or have failed despite of so much money, so much investment from these donors, and this goes nowhere. So that's what I frame as refusal to be governed. These people refuse to be governed, and then black ungovernability, to use the Helen Kwan's word, black ungovernability become the a place of inquiry. This is what I'm trying to understand, is how black ungovernability can become a possibility to create a new world.
Well, that sounds like a fantastic project. And thank you, Jamie, so much for joining us on the New Book Network. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and thanks again for taking the time for being with us.
Thank you very much, Jacob. Thank you, the listeners, for this great opportunity. Take care.